Hello, and welcome to Couch Conversations. I'm your host, Shanika Moore Clark. Join my guests and me as we explore life, love, relationships, and everything in between. I'm really excited about today's show because I have the honor of engaging in a conversation that is often very taboo, the idea of men of color and therapy. Those two words usually don't go together. So today I have the honor of talking to Dr. Orlando Wright, who holds many titles. He holds a master's in social work from the University of Connecticut. He also has a doctorate in human behavior from Capella University. He's also an author. He's also the founder and CEO of Halcyon Clinical Services, LLC. And he is also a faculty at Walden University and Charter Oak State College. So, did I miss anything? Can you share anything else about yourself? Because I don't understand how you have all of these roles, but more power to you. So, let our listeners know who you are, what you do, and so, any information.
Sorry for the mouthful, right? Part of what I do is my main focus is working with men in therapy along the lines of either, so early on I started working with men who had been charged with domestic violence, and that's where my love for working with men started, and then at the University of Connecticut I started working with the Women's Center on a program that myself and another gentleman named Eric Bulwick, we founded called Men Against Violence Against Women. And what I just found was that in my training and in my learning, one, it's been personal as well as it has been really a great experience of being in a position as a male to start to help men to come to a place where they can be better husbands, better fathers, better brothers, you know, and the likes. And so for them to really embrace their humanity in a way that I think is helpful for everyone. So that's most of what I would consider my work in terms of the therapeutic interventions or the therapeutic work that I do.
Okay. And you
did
also,
I answer that properly?
Yes, you did. You did. Okay. And I want to talk a little bit about the book that you authored, Parenting Status Offending Youth.
Uh-huh.
And mm-hmm. I believe there's another book, Soaring into Greatness. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
The Soaring into Greatness, Jackie Phillips, who was able to convince me to write a chapter in that book, we co-wrote that together. And she had some other authors. But the benefit of that book was that often, you know, you kind of see people going through life and you don't really know their story. And you can know them fairly well. What I mean by that is you're engaging with them on an ongoing basis. But you never take a moment to kind of get to know what brought them to where they're currently at in life. And so in that book, I talked about two things that were very prominent. So I grew up in St. Elizabeth, Jamaica, and then came here in my early teens. And I remember, if folks remember, if you're West Indian, you remember the common entrance back then. And
yeah.
I got money from my grandmother. And the reason why I've done all this educational stuff is I think it's connected to this moment. And the reason why it's connected to that moment is that my grandmother sent me to get tutoring for classes for the common entrance. And I used the money to buy, you know, bullet cake and certain types of sweets. And didn't use the money for what it was intended for. And back in those days, we're talking about 20-something-odd years ago, mm-hmm. we didn't have any telephone. We live in the country, so right. I'm not sure who told on me. So somebody told on me, and I remember my grandmother coming around just looking at me, shaking her head, and walking off, And then probably within minutes, if I remember correctly, my grandfather coming around, looking at me, and he's like, your grandmother gave you money to pay for your education, and you squandered it. And I tell you, man, that shame mm-hmm. and guilt and what I felt at that moment, I decided that I'm never going to do that again.
mm-hmm, right.
And, it's not unusual for you to get a spanking back in those days.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
My grandmother never took a hand. She just looked away in just pure disappointment. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I think I skipped the fifth grade. So at the time, I think I had another opportunity to do the common entrance. And I took the common entrance second year around. I remember studying really hard. And I got into what's called Monroe in St. Elizabeth. It's up in Malvern, that area, Monroe College, and which is one of our top schools in Jamaica. So for me, I think I made her really proud, and I felt like yeah. I had to continue education. And then there's a second story I told in the book about, and folks can read it if they're interested, but it's about when I moved to America and some other things that happened in high school that ultimately put me on the path to where I am now, which I thought was both pivotal points in my development.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that story. I could see that look from your grandmother. I think it was probably very deserving.
I've always been a mischievous kid, you know?
Right. That's exactly the word that I was thinking about.
I've always, I got my older daughter. I'm seeing a lot of myself in her, and she's very uh-huh. mischievous and sneaking, and I'm like, uh-oh. Uh-oh. I'm in trouble.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it always works that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, you know what? I'm curious because you are a man of color and you are in the mental health field. And I know mm-hmm. that mental health, especially in, for people of color, has historically and even to this day has been, something that has been very taboo. And especially when we're talking about men in therapy, that idea mm-hmm. is just, people are just often very resistant, especially men in the mental health field. So I'm curious to know what was it about mental health that attracted you to do this type of work?
So part of these, the reason why I mention these types of experiences is because I never thought about it as mental health early on, because you're talking about when I was in college or mid to late 90s when I started, and I was just by happenstance came on to human development, and that's what I studied in my bachelor's and loved it, and I thrived in it. And so I thought about how I knew I wanted to continue my education. And so I thought about applying to school. I only applied to one school. I applied to UConn School of Social Work. And that's where I really developed a sense of this generalist practice in terms of looking at mental health. A lot of people compartmentalize, and I never did that. And I was never attracted to things that did that. And I understood why people compartmentalize. Sometimes it's easy to deal with and it's easy to manage. So undergraduate, I did counseling, and I really didn't like doing counseling initially, which is surprising to people.
Wow. Right.
I really didn't like it. And so when I did my master's, I did community organizing, and I did a minor in group work. And so what I started to do was I exposed myself to many different things. And ultimately what I realized now, which I didn't know then, was that I always felt like people would talk about the clinical work in sort of this esoteric way. And it wasn't until there was a guy named Derek Gordon. He was my first supervisor, and he was through Yale. And that's when I used to do treatment for men. So I was doing the work, but I didn't necessarily think I was good at it, right? And mm-hmm. so I was doing this work with men in Waterbury who had been ordered by the court to participate in a curriculum we call Evolve at the time. I'm not sure if it's still around. Mm-hmm. And that's where I really – so Derek is from the islands. This brother from Yale with a MD, he's a psychiatrist, was my supervisor. And the way he talked about it, I was like, so treatment is the same thing as, you know, behavior modification. He started really connecting the dots for me, and I saw it as something that I actually enjoyed and that I could do. And it didn't become, it wasn't this esoteric thing. You know how people like to prop themselves up in ways right. that are, it's like, no. You're providing treatment. You're helping young men and young boys to think about their decisions in a way that may look different. You're providing validation. You're also helping them to explore feelings and emotions in ways that they've never done before. And for myself, you know, I'm young, and so there are things I don't know, and that process is what got me excited about the field. And so from that experience with Derek doing, we had those men twice a week. It was pretty intense. Twice a week for 2 hours each session for 26 weeks. And, you know, you made decisions about whether or not they went to jail or whether or not they successfully completed. So that was my first sort of entry into feeling excited about doing it and making the connections to, you know, simple things. It wasn't this esoteric thing that was out of my reach. And I think that was important for me to kind of venture more into the mental health field.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So in your experience in working with men, what challenges have you seen in engaging men into therapy? Because I know that a lot of men, you know, they see therapy as something that is, you know, it's not for them. Maybe it's for another culture. Right. What's been your experience with engaging with men?
I think that's an excellent question. Here's what I'm going to say. First and foremost, I think, especially men of color, I think if you have someone who looks like them that you can get through, you can cut through a lot of the cultural stuff quickly. I tend to find 85% of the folks I see in for therapy are men of color. And, I mean, they range from 14 to 50-something years old. And what I've found is that they come to me specifically because I look like them. So it tends to be the superficial thing, and I think it starts off with. So I'll give you the examples that I get from parents with their 14 and 15-year-olds. What I get from parents with their 14 and 15-year-olds is that, oh, wow, we don't see you often in terms of a therapist, and we think that there are some additional things that you can do for our child that's not just about the distress tolerance, emotion regulation. So there's a connection. There's a circular process that happens that is much more cultural for those parents. So sometimes it's an example. You know, hey, this guy has a doctorate. You know, I definitely want my child to come see him. Sometimes they're going through certain issues. And we know in our field, I'll give you an example. I've had a young man that was probably 17 years old or 18 years old at the time that was in treatment with me. And the conversation with the psychiatrist is that this is not a guy who's antisocial. He's actually experiencing trauma. And because he's experienced trauma for a long time, the manifestation of that trauma is going to be acting out. It's going to be, you know, aggressive. Mm-hmm. And what happens is he's walking around, and by the way, he has a borderline intellectual functioning. He's borderline intellectual functioning, so he presents very well. And you have this kid with all this trauma, and if you don't know that, what happens in society is that he is seen as antisocial. I didn't win that argument. And my piece is that there are that pushed me, and I regretted years ago not doing my MD because what I find is that these kids are medicated, right, mm-hmm. for things that actually require work around the trauma that they've experienced. So I find that parents on that end are coming to me because they have experienced to some degree those types of things where there are these implicit biases that happen as a result of just culturally, you know. We do know that when we are able to see the beauty in a person, their behaviors, understand them contextually, it's really important. And then with the men, you'd be surprised. I get a lot of men who are in a space of their relationship where they either have had infidelity issues or for a variety of reasons that are much more complex and nuanced than the normal society talks about, which, you know, they get beat up for cheating or they get beat up for doing various things that they shouldn't have done. But in a therapy room with another male, they get to really confront those things in a way that's not toxic. It's in a way that allows them to really explore what it means to be a human being versus this male identity that comes with a lot of loaded language and different things. And the reason what we found is that there are men that have been in treatment with me that gets to a place where they now start to see how infidelity might have harmed their relationship without being judged for being a dog, let's say, or being judged for being a horrible human being. You know, it's those type of things that I think why men reach out to me, especially men of color.
Well, right. There's so much that you brought up, a lot of good points. So the first, you know, the idea that we know that Black boys are often overdiagnosed with ADHD because oftentimes their reactions or the way that they show trauma, it may resemble what ADHD might look like. And so I'm glad that you mentioned that idea. I'm curious to know, what would you tell parents who have a Black boy, a son, who, you know, they don't believe that the ADHD diagnosis or the ODD diagnosis is accurate? How would you say, what would you say to parents about how they can, you know, advocate for their child?
You know, one of the things, so I developed a tool called Care Measure. And clinicians in the practice use this tool. And what it does is I allow parents to be a part of that screening. And it's publicly available screening tools that folks in the field have heard of. I just put it together in a way that streamlines it, right? And what I've found is that before I even have the conversation with parents, I give, you know, there's a model out there that's mostly in the world of permanency called the 357 model, developed by a lady named Darla Henry. And what that model I talked about, and especially with connections for young people, is that you put the child in the driver's seat. Now, that in our community can be tough for some people. But what I like to say is that the child may not always have the language, but when you start to talk about symptoms and certain things that they can identify with in their language, and parents get to witness this, they get a sense of, oh my goodness, what you're going through internally that you're now expressing, I get to see that firsthand. And I also don't make decisions about diagnoses within the first meeting. Mm-hmm. And so what I try to do is I try to engage the family in a way over time that we may realize that there are certain things we miss or certain nuances, not only from screening, but also from seeing what that youth may be screening for. And contextually, the context is so important because ODD, I've found, and I'll give you one example. I've had some teenagers.
And I don't mean to interrupt you. So can you just, I said ODD, but I did not share what that diagnosis is. So
oppositional defiant disorder.
Okay.
Which, you know, I tend to think that there are a lot of, I was oppositional defiant.
Right.
I'm probably still oppositional defiant. So what I often find is that we take some time. One, you want to educate parents, but two, just exposing them to what it means. And we realize that after parents start to get a sense of what's going on, like I've had parents who come in who are particularly from the West Indies, like, what is this anxiety stuff that you're talking about? And, you know, what I tell parents often is that it's you all have gone through this, right? What happened is you never had the opportunity to talk with anybody about it. So it's not that these symptoms are just now apparent. Within the culture, you may have not addressed it the way that you should. And quite frankly, it has affected a lot of people. You know, we know a lot of people from the Caribbean who are just holding on to a lot of stuff that's just toxic.
Oh, yeah.
And so I try to break it down for parents or the African-American community. I try to break it down in a way that allows them to get a sense of, one, what's going on, and that, you know, let me not forget this point. I think it was an important point, is that you have sometimes teenagers who have oppositional behaviors, but what it is that they're dealing with is really hurt and pain.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And they're hurt and pain, and it develops resentment, and they're pissed off at something that happened months or years ago, and it comes out as oppositional. And so I try to find the best ways of getting that to the surface. And I've found that that has been helpful for parents to be able to understand and also know that there's something that we can do about it.
Right. I really like that. So I think it's important for parents to really find, it sounds like finding the right fit, the right therapist,
mm-hmm.
to ask the right questions and to be
right.
very involved
right.
in the care of their children. So
mm-hmm.
There's so much more that I want us to get into, the idea of what vulnerability, because when you talked about engaging in therapy with men, what I was thinking about was the idea of vulnerability, what that looks
mm-hmm.
like. What does therapy look like? How do men find a therapist? And, you know, how do they recognize that they need therapy? I really
mm-hmm.
want to get into that. But we do have to take a quick break. Before we do that, I would love for you to tell our listeners how they can connect with you.
So folks can connect with me. The name of the company is Halcyon Clinical. .com, Halcyon clinical.com. All of our contact information is available via the website.
Welcome back to Couch Conversations. We are talking to Dr. Orlando Wright today, and we're talking all about therapy for men of color. One of the things that I've noticed about therapy and therapy for men of color is that there's the resistance to therapy. It's often rooted in the idea of therapy is a very intimate experience, and it requires some level of vulnerability and sharing. And so I'm curious to know, in your work with men, what does that look like? Because I know, you know, vulnerability looks different, and I'm so curious to know, when you as a male therapist and a man of color, and you are engaging with another man, what does that process look like?
Well, so first and foremost, let me say this. My process alone, I think, has helped me to be able to engage with men in a way that is really about two human beings looking at each other and being able to be in a space where we understand that the model of masculinity doesn't serve us anymore. Right? So this model of stoic, never having to deal with our emotions when we're hurting or going through various types of scenarios that are difficult, we you know, usually have these maladaptive ways of dealing with it. So I think I will say that my journey has made me entirely comfortable with being able to engage another man in a conversation that, one, is about human beings. Two, it's about being able to have a person know that emotions are okay, and that's the basis of it. And the vulnerability is about, you know, what we have often looked at as vulnerability through the lens of as something that is we can have further harm, right? And so what we do is we shift that. Is that vulnerability is really about your children needs you, your wife or your significant other needs you to be fully present as a human being. So that's the work that I've done over the years and also the work that I continue to do with men. I'm going to give you an example. The men that I encounter, nine times out of nine, they're sort of at this contemplative stage. So it hasn't been as difficult as you might think. And for folks out there who don't know, is I use the stages of change, which starts at pre-contemplation and contemplation. So pre-contemplation is sort of like, I don't really want to do this. I'm not ready to do this. And I think that that's really important, is that when men are ready to engage, I'm available to them to set up a session and come in and talk. And that alone helps to reduce a lot of the anxieties around talking in therapy, right, or coming to therapy. And I tend to bring into the sessions a little bit more of the experiential pieces. So you come in my therapy room, I have a board, which I actually use to provide highlights for those persons who are in therapy. So it tends to be done in a way that help them to feel comfortable. And by the way, I've had men who are from the LGBT community, and I've had men who are from different backgrounds or different cultural expressions. And so part of what I think is also helpful in that is I use humor a lot. And I remember when a young man who came in and he wanted to know how I felt about gay men. With me being a black male and him being a black male. And I said, I answered him, and I answered him as honestly as I possibly could. And I said, if that's the thing that you're worried about, you know, you shouldn't worry because, part of what that means is that it's impossible for me to do this work with you without thinking about you as a human being. And so regardless of what it is that you are involved with, whatever's troubling you, those are things that I try to make people feel comfortable. And I use a lot of humor. And that helps to break the ice quite a bit to help men feel that they can actually participate in sessions with me. And the humor is dependent on the person, so I try to make it appropriate. When you're coming in and you're hurting and you have a guy making fun of you, you're probably not the best thing.
Right, exactly.
But you may have other persons come in and you can tell they're nervous and you crack one joke with them and they lighten up a little bit. So,
I like that. Yeah, I like that because I think that, you know, people might fear therapy because it feels like, you know, I'm in this place and it's like so tense. And I think that letting folks know that therapy doesn't have to be that we are two individuals, we're two persons that are here. And I'm interested in hearing your story. I'm here to join you. I'm here to work with whatever it is that you want to work through. And that it doesn't have to be that it can, you know, there can be humor in the midst of, all the other stuff that they're working through.
So before I forget this point, there's an exercise that I also use initially in a lot of my sessions, and it's the exercise of building a house. And what I do is I actually either will have them draw the house or I will draw the house, and we often talk about how the house has a foundation. And then as you build a house, you put a roof on it. We talk about how that house needs to withstand sleet, rain, earthquakes, thunderstorms, all of these natural phenomenons that it's going to experience. And if you don't build it well, you don't have insurance. And then we do another piece with them, and I say, well, when you think about it, every single human being has feelings, they have emotions. And if you don't know how to work through or deal with things that are emotionally difficult, you know, it's the same thing like the house. You can have a wind that comes in, and if it's not built properly, it's going to take the roof off. And young boys, young men, they connect with that, right, immediately, because the analogy is how they need to really be able to regulate their emotions in a certain way, be able to deal with distress, be able to deal with certain circumstances in a way that's conducive to their development or benefit.
Okay. I like that. I think I'm going to take some notes. I might use that in my own practice.
Anytime you're ready.
I love it. My question, I'm curious, do you think that men engage differently in therapy with male therapists versus a female therapist? Do you think it matters or gender matters?
Think so. I think that there are those dynamics that are there. I'm often, the infidelity stuff is I'm shocked. And this is the thing I'm shocked about, because, you know, we can have a further debate about this down the road. But what I'm most shocked about is how many men who come in of their own accord, either they've been thinking about it or they've already done it, and now they don't know, they recognize that they did something wrong. Mm-hmm. Or they've recognized they've been doing it a long time, and they're at a place where they don't want to do it anymore, and they don't know how to, how to stop. And here's the number one thing, is it reinforces their self-esteem, right, which is a false sense of who they are, right? So if I can get, you know, as many women as I can and keep this other scenario going on over here, it feels good to them. It's exciting. And so as they start to explore this, you start to get a sense that they probably wouldn't have said these things to anybody else. Other than their boys, it's often done in a way that is like, you know, oh, yeah, I did this and this. But when you're in the therapy room, there's a real sort of come-to-Jesus moment when you start to talk about the harmful effects of your actions in those ways. I've had the surprising part is a lot of men reach out because they really do want to make different decisions. And it's not always after they've been caught.
Right.
I get it.
Right. But I get it. I think there's something to be said about having that, you know, the safety of sharing that with another man and perhaps not feeling as judged. So I get it. I think there's something definitely to be said about that. So in your work and what you know of therapy with men, what are some of the presenting challenges that, you know, would inform someone that, hey, it might be time for me to look for a therapist?
So grief, I've had folks reach out to me for that. Often feeling emotionally dysregulated, that is a big one.
Okay.
Like I mentioned, the infidelity, either, you know, going to be in a more committed relationship and don't know how to be, or is in one and has had infidelity, either known or unknown to their partner. I'm thinking about also, you may have folks who have had more of a higher level of care. So they've been hospitalized. They want to see someone. So they may need to be on medication and also be in continued treatment. So we tend to get some referrals for folks like that as well.
Okay. Now,
those are the primary purposes.
Okay. So what about things like depression? Does that, do you find that that looks different in men versus women?
I think the manifestation of it could look very different. I've had this ongoing running theory. I don't have a lot to back it up, but I just feel like somewhere along the way, the only comfortable emotion men like to talk about is anger, right? Which is, it's like cop-out. It's nonsense, right? If you think about it, it's like, hey, you know, all along, I can come to you and say that I'm angry, but I can't necessarily come to you and say that I'm hurt. Or I can come to you and say that I'm angry, but I can't necessarily tell you that I'm depressed. So some of the times we'll see that. And it takes a little bit of time to kind of tease out what's happening. And I've found that sometimes when you do a screening for someone and you get to know them contextually, it helps you to frame for them sort of their report of what's been going on. And I've found that men don't often, I've not found a lot of men who will say that they're depressed.
Right.
And I don't know why that is, but I'll find a lot of men who say that they're angry. And when you look at it, really they're depressed.
Right.
Right. So this irritability that comes out with their loved ones, it's really depression. And I think helping them to develop the language around what is authentic about that. And it takes some time. But for some reason, where the emotion we're comfortable with is anger. It's like we've marketed that in our society as a thing that's like, you know, okay. And that's, you know, it's tragic because there's emotions are much more expansive than that. So, that's what I would say that I see quite a bit in terms of the differences.
And I would say that, you know, that idea of masculinity, you know, is developed so, you know, from the beginning. So when you're a little boy, you're being taught that you don't cry. What do you mean? You have emotions? No, you don't have emotions.
Right.
You have to be strong. You have to be a man. Boys are told they have to man up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that implication of being a man when you're a boy, you know, that you hold on to that. And I think that, you know, masculinity, the way that it's viewed as, it certainly can affect the way that, you know, men deal with emotions and feelings.
Right.
And so, so I'm glad that you share that.
The way I would think about it is if you liken it to as you get older, right, there are certain things that you're going to learn along the way that you sort of, if you're wise, you get better at, right? You just sort of naturally move into that space where it's like, okay, I'm older. I know a little bit more than I did, you know, let's say in my 20s or my 30s, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so if you think about it, the one thing that happens to men sometimes is that you get to be 50 and you've had this one or two responses to life's experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And that can't possibly be healthy for any human being, right?
Right.
It's if you think about it in that way, and it's like, no, it's much more expansive. There are a lot more things that can happen with you, and it's okay. It's not a death sentence if you are hurt by something, and hurt doesn't always mean that you have to be angry about it. And, you know, when you are 50 years old, responding to situations the same way that you have in your 20s, you know, I don't see any growth there. And I think that men having permission to be much more flexible, you know, and be a human being. I keep using that word. It's like human beings come with all these things. It's like, okay, right? You know, and I think that is important. So,
and the permission given is important. So here's my other question. As a woman, and I have, I primarily in my practice, I have women that I see, but oftentimes my women client will tell me that they want their partner, whether it's their husband or their boyfriend, they feel like they need to go to therapy. And they're often interested in, you know, getting some feedback on how to encourage their partner to seek therapy. And I wanted to know if you have any suggestions for, you know, women to support. How do we go about supporting our men who we believe might benefit from therapy?
First and foremost, I've only had one successful situation where a woman called for her significant other, right?
Right.
And I think the reason why he has been successful is because he was busy, he was working, and he was entirely 100% on board. So what I would suggest is that you can have the conversation, right, about, hey, you know, I believe you should see someone for therapy, and it's going to adjust based on your partner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think you shouldn't do it for them. I think you can provide the resource, like some folks use Psychology Today. Because in my experience, every time that a woman has called me to say, hey, my son, my husband,
mm-hmm.
I ultimately know that I'm never going to hear from them again.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because it isn't initiated by that man. That man has to take the initiative to say, hey, this is something that I truly want. And unfortunately, while she may recognize it, he may not. And I think if she has the conversation, you know, that's all she can do. The most important thing is, hey, go to Psychology Today. This is how you find someone. Because what I've found is that, and this is the sad part of it, is that sometimes it is when the relationship has fallen apart that men will then participate in therapy if they're not ready. It's, you know, in essence, they're forced. But before that, I find that if you do it for your significant other or your son, it's really important that they do the groundwork themselves to follow through. So that would be my feedback to individuals in that scenario.
Okay.
There's no real.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm saying there's no real magic pill. It is a individual choice. It's going to require for them to really be engaged and want to do this, and so they have to see the benefit of it.
Right. Yeah. So I think it's like anything else. You have to be ready. Because I can imagine if you push someone into therapy and they're there and they're not ready to be there. You know,
you're not going to get the right work done.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You're not going to get the work done, and that's what makes it really really difficult, I think, for folks. And the other thing too is always remember this, and with mental health or behavioral health in general, you know, we're often experiencing sort of the manifestation, right? And not always a target of what's going on with that person. So, for example, sometimes we don't know that it's depression. We just know that they act a particular way, right? So I think it's perfectly okay to say, hey, this have changed in you. Do you think you should see someone or you can see someone? If there's a risk of violence there and that person is going to, you know, respond violently, then they're not ready to have that conversation. They may have to actually be in a position where they're forced or mandated by other means. So, for example, people come through the courts, they come through other ways to therapy, and they're mandated in that way. But I think just for someone who's having a struggle, you can make the recommendation, but and you can provide Psychology Today as a resource to find a therapist. But, you know, I think short of that, you know, people are not going to follow through with something that they really are not gung-ho about.
Right. It's like the saying, you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make the horse drink, right?
Yeah. The only way they're going to drink is if they're thirsty.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, I'm really I'm so grateful that we're having this conversation, because I think that these conversations need to be had, because there's so much misinformation about therapy and what it looks like. And I think that especially for men of color, therapy can have so many benefits. And I think that what you're bringing is more information, awareness, and helping them to understand that therapy really is not it's not a negative word, or it's not it shouldn't be taboo, but it really is something that is meant for growth.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for that.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
The thing I was going to add as well is that I'm a proponent of brief therapy.
Okay.
And so I tended to make my sessions be anywhere between 12 to 16 sessions. So, you know, folks kind of get a sense that we come in, we work on something, and then I could be finished and I have you, I could come back to you when I need you. Or if we're going to continue working on something, then it certainly has to meet the guidelines of medical necessity. So that helps people to framework, like, hey, yeah, I could do this for 3 months, or I could do this for 4 months, and get things right. And then when I'm no longer needed, because we know people fire you all the time, right? They just stop showing up.
Absolutely. Right.
So we preempt that by saying, no, this is a structured way to do it. And we find that we have more people who come in and they do their full 12 to 16 sessions, and they show up. And so that helps the buy-in early on. So.
Right. I love that. So you know that it's time limited and that you are going to be getting the work done, and it's not necessarily going to take years and years.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. So before, I want us to take another quick break. And when we come back in our final segment, I wanted us to talk about the accessibility of therapy and the investment that is involved in therapy. But before we do, I would love for you to tell our listeners again how they can connect with you.
Folks can check out Halcyon Clinical, Halcyon Clinical.com. Halcyon Clinical.com.
All right. Welcome back. We are in our final segment of Couch Conversations. Today, I have the honor of talking with Dr. Orlando Wright, who is sharing with us all of the components of therapy for men of color. And we are all the wiser by all of the wisdom that he has been sharing with us. So I wanted us to talk in this final segment about accessibility, because I know that for some folks, therapy, it seems like something that is not readily accessible to everyone because of things like finances or the cost of therapy. And I'm curious to know how can folks look at therapy in terms of the investment that's involved, and maybe talk a little bit about how insurance may be helpful.
Okay. I'll start with the insurance piece. Most therapists either get paneled with insurance companies and they can receive referral through them. I'll tell you, the reimbursement rate for some companies is just ridiculous. But the important part here is that folks, who are looking for a therapist can certainly ensure that therapist is already paneled with their insurance company. The other part is that also some therapists will offer, sliding fee scales for persons who have a certain income. So it runs the gamut. I mean, this is, we're talking about the greater D.C. area where I'm located. You have high net worth individuals who don't want to access their insurance. And so they'll pay cash. Then you have some folks who, you know, may not make as much money and they're on Medicaid. So I would recommend for clinicians to have a payer mix to be able to reach more patients, and that's really important. And then the other thing I come across is that if you think about your mental health, for everything else we will pay for, right? So if you need to go get a massage, if you need to go for a doctor visit, you know, we will take care of everything, our physical health. And so for me, I see health as health, right? So I say you train your mind, and it's often the most important thing, because what happens is there are things that can potentially happen to your body, but if your mind is not in the right place, it can also impact your body. So I see them in one and of the other. So it's really important that folks treat that in with kindness the way they do their bodies. And quite frankly, if you don't treat your mind with kindness, what happens is your body starts to be impacted. Number of studies out there show us that there's not this duality. They actually work together. So I think that that's important. In terms of access, so I'm now venturing and working with providing internships for places like the school that I currently teach at, Walden, and also with others to take on students to train them, in particular students of color who are interested in being in this field, one, from a clinical perspective, but two, from also a business perspective. I think for a long time when we think about social work, we think about all these other human services field, personnel who are in the human services field, rather, we often think, oh, no, those folks don't make a lot of money. And I'm here to tell you that if done properly and if you can set up a business, we're looking at companies that are multi-million dollar companies. We're looking at group practices that are doing very well. And so getting students to start to see the value in coming into the field, I think, is going to be really important. Second, training. It's been tough to find men of color who may want to be trained, but training for those men to come into the field to provide good quality care, good quality treatment is essential. And I think that will start to improve accessibility for, men of color or young men of color. I think that it's a multi-pronged approach.
Yeah, I agree. So I could go on and on with this conversation, but we're an hour long show, and I think that you have definitely provided us with a lot of information that would be very helpful. Before we end this show, I would love for you to leave us with some lasting words or some thoughts or any information that you think would be helpful for listeners to hear.
So one, in terms of finding resources, I tell folks to use psychologytoday.com. You can find a psychiatrist, you can find therapists. That's the way to see what's out there. You can look at it based on your insurance. There are a number of ways to do that. And then two, I tell folks, piece that I want to reiterate again is, you've got to treat your mental health, your way of thinking. There are certain patterns in your behaviors. You have to start to treat that the same way you do your physical health. They are not separate, and they should be treated as they're part of health, holistic health. And so just as much as you take a vacation to be able to relax and refine and come back again and go to the hustle and bustle of work, mm-hmm. While you're at that job and you're starting to feel anxiety or you're starting to be depressed because of various life circumstances, One of the things we do know, and cognitive behavioral therapy has proven this over the last 50 years, is that just the fact of having someone who you can talk things out with is therapeutic. And even better when you have a person who's a professional, who knows not to be invalidating, who knows how to be engaged, and who knows how to join in a professional way. Those things are all valuable to sharpening you and helping you sort of move forward to be living your best life.
Right.
So.
All right, well.
Thank you for doing this.
Right. You are so welcome. I am honored, and this conversation was important for me because I, as a therapist myself, I find that I'm often interested in hearing the perspective of men, what they need. I know that their needs are often different than what women might need, and so it's really interesting to me to hear your perspective and your expertise. So I know that our listeners have been left informed, and I thank you so much for your time. I know that taking this hour to talk about this topic, out of all of the things that you do, I don't know how you were able to provide me with this hour, but I'm super grateful. So thank you.
One day I'll tell you, it's all this process we call integrative. And trust me, it's not as busy as you think it is.
Okay, well, I'll take your word for it.
I don't think you believe that one.
I'll take your word.
But thank you for having me. It was a pleasure. This was a great conversation.
Good, good. Well, I thank you all for listening and tuning in for another show. I'm your host, Shanika Moore Clark, and you have just listened to Couch Conversations. Join me for another episode of Couch Conversations, where we explore life, love, relationships, and everything in between. Be well.